Traber's Nervous Illness by Carol Churchill. Based on Memoirs of My Nervous Illness by Daniel Paul Schreiber. Translated by Ida McElfine and Richard A. Hunter. With Kenneth Hague as Daniel Paul Schreiber.
Daniel Paul Schreiber, a judge, spent 10 years in asylums as a schizophrenic and wrote his memoirs there.
God was always in a precarious position. The human soul is contained in the nerves of the body. God is all nerve, and his nerves turn into whatever he wishes to create. But although he enjoys what he has created, he has to leave it to its own devices, and only rarely make contact with human nerves, because they have such an attraction for God's nerves that he might not be able to get free, and would endanger his own existence. My doctor, Professor Flexig, had an ancestor who abused his power as a nerve specialist by keeping hold of some divine nerves and conspiring with them against the Schreiber family, plotting to deny them children or a profession like nerve specialist, which would bring them closer to God. Nerve contact was made with the Schreibers regardless of the danger to both God and the Schreiber souls. Lexic finally tried to commit soul murder, taking over another's mental powers. Soul murder has been attempted on me. And so the order of the world has been broken, and God and I find ourselves in a situation that has never arisen before. His existence is now threatened by mine, for his nerves stream into my body against their will and cry continually in the sky for help.
The retired president of the Court of Appeal, Daniel Paul Schreiber, Doctor of Law of Dresden, was admitted to this asylum at Sonnenstein, of which I, Dr. Weber, am the director, in 1894, and has been here ever since. It is not his first illness. 10 years earlier, he was treated for a serious attack of hypochondria by Professor Flechtig.
White lies may sometimes be indispensable to a nerve specialist, but were hardly appropriate in my case. Or Professor Flexig must soon have realized he was dealing with a human being of high intellect. But I was eventually cured, and therefore I had at the time no reason to be other than most grateful to Professor Flexig. My wife worshipped him as the man who had restored her husband to her and kept his picture on her desk for many years. After my recovery, we had quite a happy life, despite the repeated disappointment of our hope of being blessed with children. I was nearly 50 and did not like to think of the Schreiber family tree coming to an end with me. But in 1893, I had the very great honor for one so comparatively young to be appointed president to the Court of Appeal at Dresden. While waiting to take up office, I occasionally dreamt that my nervous illness had returned. One morning, while still in bed, I had the highly peculiar feeling that it really must be rather pleasant to be a woman submitting to intercourse. This idea was so foreign to my whole nature that if I had been fully awake, I would have rejected it with indignation. As president of the Court of Appeal, I had to preside over 5 judges as much as 20 years senior to me, and all at home with procedure which was new to me. I was driven to achieve their respect by unquestionable efficiency, so that I soon overtaxed myself mentally. By the time I had mastered my office, I was sleeping badly. Again and again, I was woken by a recurrent crackling in the wall of our bedroom. Naturally, we thought of a mouse. But I now recognize such noises as undoubted divine miracles. Right from the beginning, there was the intention to prevent my sleep. My illness began to assume a menacing character, so my wife and I traveled to Leipzig to see Professor Flexig. I was moved by his eloquence when he spoke of the advances in psychiatry since my first illness and gave me hope of curing me completely with one prolific sleep. But the sleeping drug failed. During the night, I got up in an attack of anxiety to make a kind of suicidal attempt with a towel, which woke my wife. Next morning, Professor Flexig took me to his asylum.
At the beginning of his second stay at Professor Flechsig's clinic, President Schreiber mentioned mostly hypochondriacal ideas and said he would soon die.
I continued without sleep. I could not occupy myself in any way. Even jigsaw puzzles or patients increased my nervous tension so much that I had to stop. So I passed the days in endless melancholy, thinking almost exclusively of death. My wife tried again and again to raise my spirits with plans for the future. I could only shake my head in disbelief. When she went away for a few days, my condition deteriorated so much that I said I did not wish her to see me in such a low state. And her visits ceased. Then began the communication with supernatural powers. Particularly the nerve contact Professor Flechsig kept up with me so that he spoke to my nerves without being present in person. I realized he had secret designs against me. I had begun to distrust him when I asked him if he really honestly believed I could be cured, and he held out certain hopes, but could no longer look me straight in the eye.
Ideas of persecution soon appeared in the disease picture, based on hallucinations, which at first occurred sporadically, but later ruled his whole thinking and feeling.
Professor Flechsig and the divine nerve rays under his control forced me to think incessantly and denied me man's natural right to give his nerves a rest by sleeping or at least thinking nothing.
What are you thinking of now?
When my nerves did not reply, the question was answered for me by the rays. Falsifying.
She should think about the order of the world.
Why do you not say it aloud?
Because I am stupid.
Though it was dangerous for God to approach living beings, it was quite safe for him to draw the nerves of a corpse up to himself. They were then purified so that he could make use of them. They became part of him as the four courts of heaven, protecting both the lower god Ahriman and the upper god Ormud from contact with human nerves. The state of blessedness of male souls was incidentally superior to the female state, which was an uninterrupted feeling of voluptuousness. But now God's nerves were attracted away from him towards me so that all states of blessedness ceased. The souls which were not yet purified were also attracted, and soon Professor Flechsig was joined by hundreds, if not thousands, of dead souls.
Flechsig described the highest
270. Though God might destroy mankind if it threatened his existence, the order of the world provides that one good man would always be spared, and he would be unmanned so that he could bear children and repopulate the world. Twice the male genitals have withdrawn into my body, and I have felt a quickening like the first sign of life of an embryo. Only the fact that as well as God's pure rays, impure souls like Flechsig were present prevented the completion of the process in accordance with the order of the world. The chosen survivor is looked after, while nobody else exists, by fleeting improvised men, set down by miracle when they are needed. Since all the figures I saw at this time were not real people, I did not feel inclined to speak to them. Professor Flechsig knew about the unmanning. He laid a plot that my female body should not be used to repopulate the world, but be handed over to someone for sexual misuse and left to rot. My medical treatment was designed to further his plot. I was kept in bed for weeks, and my clothes were removed to make me more amenable to female voluptuousness. I was given medicines for the same purpose, which I spat out when the attendant poured them forcibly into my mouth.
It is your duty to fight the attendant.
That will show your manly.
It is your duty to starve yourself to death.
If you die, this will be abused.
Why don't you drown yourself in the lake?
Because I have no back.
I repeatedly put my head underwater. Sometimes the attendants would pull up my feet for a joke, or repeatedly duck my head and then force me to leave the bath. It was natural for me to see my real enemy only in Professor Flexig, and to regard God as my ally. It was not until later that I realized that God must have known of the plan to commit soul murder on me and hand me over as a female harlot, if indeed it was not his idea. But though this may seem abominable, the instinct of self-preservation can be roused in God as in anyone else, and it was only this that made him try to destroy me. The idea of morality can only arise within the order of the world, the natural bond that holds God and man together. When that is broken, power alone counts. So neither on God's nor my part can there be a question of moral infringement. My increasing nervousness attracted more and more souls who lived in my head for a short time as little men and then dissolved in my body. And they dripped from the sky onto my head as thousands of little men. Bad news came in from all sides.
Orion has been given up.
Venus is flooded.
The solar system will have to be disconnected.
Only the Pleiades can be saved.
The human race lasted 14,000 years. Now,
the Earth has only 200 years to go.
It is over now.
I was the last human being left. The figures of Flexig, my attendants, the strange patients were all fleeting, improvised men. The starry sky seemed to be extinguished. I could not make sure as my bedroom window was closed up by a heavy shutter at night. I was sitting in a railway carriage, driving into the depths of the earth and into the past. First, there were forests of leafy trees, but as we went lower, it became darker and blacker. I walked across a large cemetery where I crossed my own wife's grave. Sitting again in the vehicle, I advanced only to point three. Point one, the earliest beginning of mankind, I dare not enter. I was raised up to blessedness. Below me, the whole earth rested under a blue vault. I frequently sat on the floor of my bedroom, clad only in a shirt. My hands, which I set firmly on the floor behind my back, were lifted up at times by black bears. If I looked through the peephole in my door, I saw small yellow men whom I had to be ready to fight. Outside the window, cats with glowing eyes appeared in the trees of the asylum garden. Professor Flexig went away for the Easter holidays. He kept calling himself God Flexig, so that his wife thought he was mad. He shot himself in the police station in Leipzig. I saw his funeral procession. I realize now that this is not what actually happened, but it is the divine opinion of what should have happened to him. What is quite certain is that I had Flexig's whole soul in my body. It was a fairly bulky ball thrown into my belly to perish. But when it tried to get free, I was moved by pity and let it escape through my mouth. I remember distinctly the foul taste and smell. I was no longer kept in bed, but walked regularly in the garden. There were two suns in the sky.
That is next week's miracle.
When I sat on a camp stool in the garden in a black coat with a black flap hat, I felt like a marble guest who had returned from times long past into a strange world.
The patient sat for hours completely immobile in an hallucinatory stupor.
I have since noticed with interest in Krepelin's textbook of psychiatry that many people whose nerves were excited had been in contact with supernatural voices accompanied by visual hallucinations. But it seems psychologically impossible that I suffer from hallucinations. The hallucination of being in contact with God can only develop in someone who already has faith in God. But I was never a believer. My gift lay in cool intellectual criticism rather than an unbounded imagination. I had occupied myself too much with the doctrine of evolution to believe Christian teaching, so it is impossible that what I have experienced should be imagination. Psychiatry will have to recognize that occasionally the phenomena may be connected with real happenings and cannot be brushed aside under the catchword hallucination.
Schreiber is transferred to Dr. Pearson's private asylum, known to him as the Devil's Kitchen.
Early one morning, perhaps in June, three attendants appeared in my cell with a suitcase and told me I was leaving the asylum. Since they were only fleeting, improvised men, I did not think it worth asking where the journey was to lead. And in any case, I could not fare worse than I had in Flexig's asylum. I never saw him again. As soon as I arrived at the Devil's Kitchen, I was surrounded by fleeting, improvised men. Everyone in the asylum looked like someone I knew. My special attendant was an attendant of the Court of Appeal in Dresden. The chief attendant was a young man called Mr. von W., whom I had met at an East Coast resort.
He has already led another life as the insurance agent Mark on another planet.
When I left Flexig's asylum, he drew up to heaven some of von W.'s nerves so that he still influenced me by influencing my attendant. I was amused to see that though they were allied against God, they disliked each other. Impure souls were graded as Satans, devils, senior devils, and basic devils. And when they appeared as fleeting improvised men, they were carrot red with a peculiar offensive odor. Von W. had a red face and hands. And so I boxed his ears to be rid of the voices. I was let out into a pen, a desolate sand pit without bush or shrub, and nothing to sit on but two primitive benches. Into this pen were crammed 40 or 50 people. Sometimes, while I was looking at one, he would suddenly run about with a different head. When the signal was given to come in, they all crowded to the door, but there would not have been enough room for them all in the asylum, and I think some stayed outside and dissolved, since they were after all fleeting, improvised men. Among them was a cousin of my wife's who had shot himself. He ran about continuously with a bundle of newspapers, which he used as something soft to sit upon on the hard wooden benches. Now that the world had come to an end, an attempt was made on a distant star to create a new human race by using some of my nerves.
Creation will only extend as far as the fishes,
as far as the reptiles,
as far as the lower mammals.
There are new human beings out to spread us.
They are very small. They are quite helpful. They do.
Framework in their natural state.
I did indeed have this friendly soul in my belly. He had a peculiarly practical turn of mind, a fundamental trait of my own character, so that I recognized in him flesh of my flesh and blood of my blood.
The terrible miracles of the first year at Sonnenstein and how Schreiber's attitude changed.
In June 1894, after 2 weeks at Dr. Pearson's private asylum, the patient was transferred to the country asylum, Sonnenstein. He was at first completely inaccessible.
I was still convinced I was not dealing with human beings, so I kept mostly silent, and I must leave open the possibility that I was right. One day I saw my wife enter my room, and I was petrified, for I knew she was dead. Her reappearance is an unsolved riddle to this day. I did not say very much to her, as I thought she was fleetingly improvised for the occasion and would dissolve on the stairs.
This physically strong man lay or stood immobile, though with jerking of the facial muscles and tremor of the hand, and stared with frightened eyes into space. He refused nourishment, so that he had to be forcibly fed, and it was only with great difficulty that he was gradually made to eat regularly again. He also retained his stool, apparently deliberately, so that he was at times incontinent.
Even now, the miracles I experience hourly would frighten any other person to death. But they are nothing in comparison to the miracles to my body during that first year at Sonnenstein. I had a worm in my lungs, my ribs were often smashed, or my chest was compressed so tightly that I could not breathe. My stomach disappeared altogether so that I could not eat. Sometimes Von W. would provide a stomach for me by miracle just before a meal, but often he changed his mind and suddenly took it away again, so that food and drink were simply poured into my empty abdomen and ran down into my thighs. I gradually went ahead with eating without a stomach and grew quite calm about everything that happened. This may sound extremely strange, but what can be more definite for a human being than what he has lived through and felt on his own body? Far more threatening were the miracles against my reason. Sometimes my skull was sawn apart in an attempt to pull the nerves out of my head. There were two little men in my feet, a little Flexig and a little Von W, who attempted to pump out my spinal cord, which next to the head was considered the seat of reason. One can imagine my apprehension as I saw it float out of my mouth in little clouds as I walked in the garden, and I did not know whether my reason was vanishing into the air. The little men also interfere with my eyes, because the ray's power is lessened if they see something, so they kept closing my eyelids. If I wiped them off my eyes with a sponge, it was considered a crime against God's gift of miracles, and the little men were at once set down afresh. Hundreds of little devils were assembled on my head looking for signs of its destruction. They had a horrible head-compressing machine, like a vice, which was screwed up till my head was almost pear-shaped, and of course gave me great pain. These severe miracles lasted only a few months, but for some time my whole body was tormented. When walking, I was forced to lie down. When I lay down, I was chased off the bed. The rays did not seem to realize that a human being who actually exists must be somewhere. I had become an embarrassment for God in whatever position I might be. My outward life was very monotonous during the first year at Sonnenstein. I mainly sat motionless the whole day on a chair at my table. Even in the garden, I sat still. I considered immobility a duty to God, to free him from the embarrassment in which he found himself. I could attract more impure souls by lying still, and by destroying them in my body, give God more power in the sky. So I made the sacrifice of desisting from every movement for several months. I did not dare change my position in bed. But the holiness of my purpose was so attractive to the divine rays that they could not forsake me. So one began to falsify my frame of mind through miracles to give the impression of a frivolous human being given only to the pleasure of the moment, whose attraction, it was hoped, would be less. I tried to live for the day and accept what life had to offer. I started smoking cigars again, which I had not done for years. But even so, the rays did not achieve their purpose. As with all miracles contrary to the order of the world, they had willed evil, but created good. For they did not manage to weaken the attraction of my nerves, but only made me feel less unhappy. And so a period of great suffering came to an end.
Schreiber's life improves, but he is still under attack.
In November, the patient's stiff posture loosened a little. He became more mobile and started to speak coherently. Gradually, his excitement mounted, with loud laughter night and day and persistent hammering on the piano. Or he raved in his room against soul murderer Fetzig, or shouted abuse out of his window at night so loudly that the townspeople gathered and complained. On the other hand, he could now read and play chess and play the piano, and was more amenable even in the middle of one of these noisy scenes, answering simple questions in a somewhat patronizing way.
My living conditions now became more bearable. A small piano was put into my room, and it was a great help in drowning out the nonsensical twaddle talked by the rays, who, of course, tried to stop me playing. My fingers were paralyzed. The direction of my gaze was changed so that I could not find the correct keys. Even the piano itself was the object of miracles, and the strings frequently broken. Superficial judgment might lead some to assume that I caused the strings to snap by senseless banging. This was my wife's repeatedly stated opinion. But let anyone try to hit the keys as hard as he likes, even with a hammer or a log of wood. The keyboard may be broken to pieces, but he will never break a string. Though my outward life had improved, there was still the attempt to unman me. Not to renew the world, but to degrade me, because it was thought that an unmanned body would lose its attraction for rays. My sexual organ was retracted, my moustache removed, and the lower god Ahriman sometimes spoke.
I wonder what is to make you somewhat small.
My body indeed shrank about 6 centimeters, approximating the size of a female body.
Is he not unmanned yet?
I suppressed every feminine impulse. The female nerves that had penetrated my body in great masses could not gain any influence over my way of thinking, though I could not prevent, when lying in bed, a feeling of soul voluptuousness, well-being, without real sexual excitement. At last, God realized that unmanning was not the way to free himself. But God's new plan came from another mistaken idea. Day after day, the rays heaped poison from corpses on my body, hoping to suffocate me and destroy my reason, which God wrongly thought would weaken my attraction. Sometimes I put my feet through the iron bars of the window at night to expose them to the cold rain, which diverted the rays' attention from my head, so that I felt perfectly well except for frozen feet. But the physicians fixed heavy wooden shutters on my window and locked them at night so that my bedroom was in total darkness. They probably had no idea how this affected me in my struggle to defend my reason. What harm could have come to me other than catching a cold? I could only see the physicians as tools of the rays.
Schreiber accepts that his turning into a woman, the miracles become less harmful.
The patient was frequently found in his room half undressed. He declared he had feminine breasts, and he had his moustache removed.
The signs that I was changing into a woman became so marked that I could not ignore them. First, my hands and arms changed, then my legs, bosom, and buttocks. My male sexual organ was only prevented from disappearing by my resolutely setting my will against it. But after a few days' observation of my body, the direction of my will changed completely. I could see the order of the world demanded my unmanning, whether I liked it or not, and it was common sense to reconcile myself to becoming a woman. This would clearly lead to fertilization by divine rays to create new human beings.
In front of your wife.
Fancy the president of the Court of Appeal letting himself be
but I did not let the rays divert me from my purpose. I would like to meet the man who, faced with the choice of becoming a lunatic or a spirited woman, would not choose the latter. I can deplore the situation, but cannot change it. I must guard against false sentimentality. My new attitude caused a change in celestial conditions. If the rays found voluptuousness in my body, it was an adequate substitute for the heavenly blessedness they had lost. Now, the voluptuousness was so great that some rays began to like entering my body. I considered it my right and duty to cultivate feelings of voluptuousness. To attract the rays, I must imagine myself as man and woman in one person having intercourse with myself. It has nothing whatever to do with masturbation. God demands constant enjoyment, which is the normal state for souls within the order of the world. And since he cannot escape from my nerves, it is my duty to provide him with it. If I can get a little sexual pleasure in the process, it seems a small compensation for my years of suffering. Ahriman's miracles became more harmless now, and the voices more nonsensical and so easier to bear, as they fitted in better with the right of a man to think nothing.
David and
Solomon, little heaps of flowers.
Sometimes there were phrases which show that God was not so devoid of understanding as he sometimes appeared. There was the thought that the policy of destroying my reason had failed.
Permanent successes are on the side.
Sometimes there was even an admission of guilt.
If only I had not put you among the fleeting, improvised men.
Even God was aware of a thoroughly mismanaged affair. Through his complete failure to understand human beings, God thinks that if no thoughts are formulated in words, the person is demented. I am made to bellow to give the impression of someone bellowing because he is demented. Constant thinking is impossible. It is also impossible to spend the whole day in a state of voluptuousness. The art of conducting my life in the mad position in which I find myself, the absurd relationship between myself and God, is to find a fitting middle course. Though I now spent my time peacefully reading or playing chess, and almost entirely avoided violence, for 2.5 years I did not sleep in my own room, but in the padded cells for demented people. It is possible I sometimes spoke aloud at night. I was forced to make a noise, to drown the senseless twaddle of the voices. I spent several hours of almost every night pounding with my fist against the closed shutters, or groping in the dark cell, and, by miracles, being made to hit my head against the ceiling rather than remain in bed when I could not sleep. No other patient had to stay in these cells more than a few weeks. I was kept there for 2.5 years. I do not wish to be acrimonious, but my sufferings there were unbearable. How could I convince God that I existed when there was nothing in the cell but an iron bedstead, a bedpan, and some bedding, and no light? Sometimes, for hours on end, I tied knots in the corners of my handkerchief, counted aloud, particularly in French, repeated all the Russian departments, and so on. And I suffered all this for 2.5 years because human beings did not understand supernatural matters.
Schreiber decides that other people exist and shows how everything they do is caused by miracles.
A change was noticed in the patient. He entered into a lively correspondence with his relatives, and it must be admitted that the letters hardly showed anything pathological, but rather a certain insight. The insulting laughing and shouting continued, so that the nightly isolation had to be maintained, but his occupations became more various and continuous. He was still little inclined to serious conversation, and soon started to grimace and utter short interjection.
Every word spoken near me is accompanied by a painful blow directed at my head. So at the slightest sound, such as opening the lock on my door, pressing the latch, the entry of the attendant, I experience a pain like a pulling inside my head as God withdraws, tearing off part of the bony substance of my skull. I have incontestable proof that everything said around me is caused by miracles. The rays that God sent loaded with poison to destroy my reason have appeared for years as talking birds. At dinner, Dr. Weber keeps using words from the bird's material so often that it is beyond possibility of coincidence. The rays continue their miracles against me, but they are becoming weaker. They begin sentences which used to be complete when they had more thoughts of their own, but now I must complete them.
Now I shall
resign myself to becoming stupid. It is hard to give a picture of the mental torture I suffered through being irresistibly compelled to finish every phrase the rays began. Gradually, however, I accustomed my nerves to ignoring them by simply repeating what the rays had said, and so turning them into not thinking anything thoughts.
Why, because I.
Another unbearable change is that the voices have slowed down.
Why do you not shit?
I must explain the question, why do you not shit? God's complete lack of knowledge of the human being makes him think that to shit is the final act, and that when I empty my bowels, the goal of destroying my reason is reached. But whenever the need to defecate is produced by miracle, some other person is sent to the lavatory. This I have observed so regularly that one can exclude any thought of it being coincidence. I find now that I can manage best when I sit on a bucket in front of the piano and play till I can empty my bowels. Miracles are directed against me and all objects I use. Miracles make people speak, cough, sneeze, make horse neigh and dogs bark, make gnats swarm around me in the garden. But all this activity, contrary to the order of the world, is to no purpose, as human beings and animals can do these things anyhow, and insects exist already in vast numbers. The miracles are at best a senseless game, at worst a torment. Even for God, the situation is fraught with evils. His joy over newly created things soon gives way to anxiety, and his nerves still come down to me with cries for help.
Help! Help!
Everything that happens now is in relation to me. People may be tempted to think I am pathologically conceited. I know this very tendency to relate everything to oneself is common among mental patients. But in my case, it is from God's point of view that I have become the human being round whom everything turns. God can no longer claim infallibility, since he entered into a relationship with me contrary to the order of the world. It was he himself who devised the whole policy against me. For a full year, I was concerned for my reason. But all attempts at unmanning me for sexual abuse and destroying my reason have failed. The order of the world does not provide even God with means of destroying a human being's reason. So, from this apparently unequal struggle between a weak human being and God, I emerge, despite my bitter sufferings, triumphant, because the order of the world is on my side.
Schreiber decides to work for his discharge from the asylum.
The patient has shown a recent change of attitude. Whereas previously, perhaps because of a more marked feeling of being ill, he was resigned to his fate, he now energetically demands the lifting of his tutelage and expects to return home. Whether President Schreiber is to be considered deprived of his reason in terms of the law by virtue of his paranoia is for the court to decide.
The result of my approach to the authorities was that a formal order for my tutelage was made in 1900 based on a report by Dr. Weber. So I brought an action against the prosecuting authority to have my tutelage rescinded.
I have delayed making a further report about President Schreiber's mental state because his condition has not undergone a marked change. If evidence is demanded of actual events which would prove he is incapable of managing his affairs, it is obviously very difficult in the case of a patient who has been interned in an asylum for many years. Although he has recently taken meals at my table and joined in excursions to Dresden, convincing results one way or the other have not been obtained. Whatever we discussed at dinner, such as law, politics, or literature, he showed keen interest and correct judgment. Sometimes, however, he will stare rigidly, grimace, and clear his throat. It required his greatest energy not to utter bellowing noises, and while he was on his way to his room, one could hear his inarticulate sounds. He hopes that his prolonged attacks of bellowing will improve, and he thinks he could avoid disturbing his neighbors by living in a house with a large garden. But in his morbid egoism, he does not consider how his wife would suffer. Whether the patient would live within his means is not certain. His striving for scientific recognition of his ideas might lead him into great expense. He still has no insight into the pathological nature of his ideas, and seeks to have his memoirs published, of course without success. It is incomprehensible that a man otherwise of fine feeling could propose an action which would compromise him so severely in the eyes of the public, were not his whole attitude to life pathological. The memoirs themselves afford the judge the necessary basis for a judgment as to whether the mental illness is sufficient to prevent the patient looking after his affairs.
In 1902, the order for my tutelage was confirmed. My last hope of having it rescinded was the Court of Appeal at Dresden, of which I was formerly president. I made the appeal myself in the following terms. I do not deny that my nervous system has for a number of years been in the pathological state, but I absolutely deny that I am mentally ill or ever have been. I do not wish to offend Dr. Weber, but I must express my conviction of the error of his report. The question whether the voices I hear are caused only by a pathological disturbance of my nerves, or whether some external being speaks to me, is simply one assertion versus another. I cannot prove the miracles, but only wish people to recognize their possibility and not to dismiss the whole affair as nonsense. It remains to discuss whether this assumed mental illness makes me incapable of looking after my affairs. The onus of proof lies with my opponent, the public prosecutor. In the last year, I have gone out unaccompanied, and nobody has noticed the slightest unreasonable behavior. The only thing that could be considered unreasonable is that I was seen standing in front of the mirror with ribbons and cheap necklaces on my body. This only happens when I am alone, never if I can help it in front of other people. The small acquisitions cost only a few pence, so do not come under consideration from a financial point of view. They are bought only to create a certain impression on God, and for this almost valueless articles suffice. Naturally, I would spare my wife any painful sight. I showed her my adornments only with some reluctance, when, out of forgivable feminine inquisitiveness, she insisted upon it. I would not expect her to live with me if it should be unbearable for her because of continued attacks of bellowing. Dr. Weber misjudges me when he speaks of my pathological egoism and claims I do not give a thought to my wife's suffering. If any nuisance should arise from the bellowing, I would return to a closed institution of my own free will. But I must insist that my stay in the asylum is a measure to which I give my free assent as a human being capable of looking after his own affairs.
To be asked by the Court of Appeal to give another report is a task little congenial to me. I have been his doctor for many years. The relationship between us is a friendly one. But I am asked to make a report which may question his tutelage and deprive him of further happiness. I would have welcomed it if another expert had been called. The patient says in his appeal that my previous report assumes his ideas are pathological, but it is not an assumption. I can trace in the history of his illness how the hallucinations gradually developed till at last his system of ideas was formed. His legal representative makes the point that many people believe in miracles without anyone declaring them mentally ill. But the patient's belief is not the ordinary naive belief in miracles, but is contrary to his earlier beliefs and grew out of his illness. It cannot be expected that the patient will see that the hallucinatory events are entirely subjective. He tries to show that his hallucinations are special and find a basis of reality for them. But this is done by every hallucinating person. Otherwise, he would not be suffering from hallucination. The patient is now allowed out unaccompanied, and his conduct is never incorrect, though he cannot avoid being conspicuous. Unless his control of the bellowing improves, he will certainly be a disturbance at home. I am very sorry to hurt his feelings by referring to his pathological egoism. I only meant that he underestimates his effect on other people. Married life would require considerable self-denial on the part of his wife. The court will know best how to judge these deviations from the normal. I would like to stress that they concern relatively unimportant fields. Apprehension for the future need not weigh as heavily now as previously.
Judgment of the Appeal Court of Dresden in the case of Daniel Schreiber, Doctor of Law, President of the Appeal Court, retired, now residing in the country asylum Sonnenstein, versus the public prosecutor recontesting the order placing plaintiff under tutelage. The court has no doubt that plaintiff is insane, but to objective observation is hallucination, is for him irrefutable certainty. But it is not sufficient grounds for placing plaintiff under tutelage that his mental processes are pathologically disturbed. It is necessary to establish that he is incapable of managing his affairs. The burden of proof rests with him who requests the order for tutelage. One observation forced upon the judge was that President Schreiber's intellectual powers had in no way suffered by his illness. Capacity to think logically is not, however, a sign of the ability to judge correctly all practical matters. The plaintiff's movements outside the asylum have not given rise to any trouble worth mentioning, and he has dealt with the money allowed him in an orderly fashion. He has not wasted money on his belief in miracles. The money he spends on female adornments is insignificant. Much greater sums are spent on whims by healthy people. It is said the marital bond with his wife is threatened by his release, but for years he has lived apart from his wife, so how could the relationship be worsened? Whether he will improve it by living with her is uncertain. One would have to try and see. But this has no bearing on his tutelage, which must be for the well-being of the person concerned and not to protect the feelings of others. It only remains that plaintiff might compromise himself by the publication of his memoirs, but one considers him mad in any case. The Court of Appeal therefore believes that plaintiff is capable of dealing with the demands of life whose orderly regulation is the object of the law. The tutelage inflicted on plaintiff is rescinded.
I am shortly to be discharged from the asylum. I naturally wonder about my future. For a long time I have expected to turn into a woman, but whether it can be accomplished in conditions contrary to the order of the world, I dare not predict. It is possible that despite strong indications of femaleness, I shall die a man. Being released from the asylum is no compensation for the suffering of the past 7 years. Some magnificent satisfaction must be in store for me. While still in Flexig's asylum, I coined the phrase, there must be an equalizing justice. Now I am beginning to have some idea of my reward. Every day there are times when I float in voluptuousness. An indescribable feeling of well-being pervades my body. It is short-lived. At the height of voluptuousness, headache or toothache is produced by miracle. Sometimes I enjoy voluptuousness up to my neck while my head is in a bad way. But in the future, voluptuousness will prevail, and I will enjoy in my lifetime the blessedness granted to other human beings only after death. As for my life at present, the miracles are more and more harmless. The voices have slowed down so much that their hissing is like the sound of sand trickling through an hourglass. I can distinguish individual words only with difficulty. Naturally, I do not bother, but try to ignore what is spoken. As soon as I have silenced the voices, I hear the talking birds. But what they say is immaterial to me. I am no longer hurt when the birds I feed cry out.
Are you not
bellowing does not occur, provided I count. But it is not easy to count for hours, so sometimes I get out of bed and carry on some occupation to show I am a thinking person. In public places, I can prevent bellowing almost completely by counting, though I may have to make some little noise like coughing or yawning somewhat ill-manneredly. But while going for walks along country roads or in the fields, I make things easy for myself and simply let the bellowing happen. Sometimes it continues for 5 or 10 minutes, during which time I feel perfectly well. Anyone who saw me would, however, hardly understand what I was doing and might really think he was seeing a madman.
What happened to Schreiber after he left Sonnenstein is not certain. It is said that his family bought up most copies of his memoirs and destroyed them. There is some evidence that when his wife died 4 years after his discharge, he was again admitted to an asylum and died there 5 years later.
Kenneth Haig played Daniel Paul Schreiber in Schreiber's Nervous Illness by Carol Churchill. Based on Memoirs of My Nervous Illness by Daniel Paul Schreiber, translated by Ida McAlpine and Richard A. Hunter. Others taking part were William Fox, Weber, John Ruddock, the judge, Louis Stringer, the narrator. Other voices, Brian Haynes, Michael Kilgariff, John Sampson, and Sheila Grant. The stereophonic production was by John Tiedemann.